There are entities that are taking a close look at our civilization and doing so with impunity, whether it's at military installations or any other way. But, you know, if they wanted to do us damage or some kind of hurt, and I'm not sure that this is what the military is saying in our country. By our country, I mean the United States, where I live. I'm not sure that the military is saying so much, but I think what's important for us to understand is, you know, if these highly evolved beings, if these entities, if you will, intended to do us damage, harm, they could have done that 150 years ago or earlier, to say nothing of last week or last month or last year or 20 years ago. So the evidence suggests that they mean us no harm, but that they simply want to find out and to learn and are finding ways to discover with impunity what our current capabilities are so that they don't inadvertently create a response from the military establishments of this world that could inure against our own benefit, that could hurt us. You know, much as you would tell a child, you know, be careful, don't play with matches. But before you did that, you'd have to find out whether the child even found a way to get access to matches or even know what matches are or how they work. So I think that what the highly evolved beings are doing is they're acting as college graduates with PhDs looking into the bedroom of their grandchildren to see if they have yet figured out how to use a match. About everything that could go wrong was going wrong at once. You know, usually earlier in my life, maybe my relationship wasn't going so well, but my career was doing fine and my health was okay. Or maybe it was the other way around. Maybe I was running into some rocky times at my place of business, at my work, but my relationship was going fine, or my health. And, you know, one or the other, I could never seem to get all three going well, but now it was just the opposite, a flip. That is, all three had fallen apart at the same moment. My relationship with my significant other at that time had ended. My job ended. I was let go, downsized, as they like to say, in the corporate world. So, but what it came down to is I was simply out of work, out of a job, rather abruptly and unexpectedly. And so with those two things weren't bad enough. At the same time, I wound up in an automobile accident. An older gentleman turned his car right in front of me, and I wound up crashing into him. I was not driving very rapidly, 25 miles per hour, which is not fast, but I did some damage to my car and his car. But worse yet, I broke my neck. I suffered a broken neck, and it wasn't what you'd call a hairline fracture. It was a 3/4 inch avulsion fracture of the 7th cervical vertebrae posteriorly. I remember the wording of the, you know, of the report exactly, because it affected my life so profoundly. A 3/4 inch fracture of your neck is big enough to put a pencil through. So we're not talking about a hairline fracture. We're talking about a very severe break and separation. And, you know, what the surgeons told me afterward at the hospital, it's amazing you didn't die. People often die with that kind of a fracture because it severs the spinal cord, or at least they're paralyzed for life from the neck down. But you managed to escape both. It's going to take a while to rehabilitate your neck, but you escaped both of the worst outcomes. So I thought, wow, interesting. What an interesting thing for all three things to happen at the same time. My relationship, my health, and my work, all falling apart at the same time. So as I was trying to rehab myself, they gave me what's known in the United States as a Philadelphia collar. That's a plastic collar that you put under your chin, and it fits the space between your chin and the top of your body. and it holds your head up, literally holds your head in place, because the doctor said, imagine having a basketball on the head of a pin. That's what we're dealing with right now. So you don't want to take that collar off for any reason. You wear it in the shower. You wear it when you sleep. You wear it 24 hours a day. Do not take the collar off. I said, okay, I got it. But there I was, trying to get my life back together again. At one night, J.I. called out. I woke up at 4:23 in the morning, and I woke up, before dawn, and I was lying there in bed, and I called out. I just really cried out to God. Okay, if you're really there, if there really is a God, what is going on? What does it take to make life work? And what have I done to deserve a life of such ongoing struggle, one thing after the other? You know what? Tell me the rules. I'll play. I swear I will play. Just give me the rule book. Because here I am. I'm thinking that I'm doing, I'm playing fair. I'm a fairly nice human being. I haven't hurt anybody drastically in my life. I don't cheat. I don't rob. I don't steal. I don't lie. What am I doing wrong here? What is it I don't understand? And I was furious. And I was so angry that I threw the covers back and went out to the living room in this tiny little grandma apartment. It was a little cottage behind someone's house in which I lived. And I sat down on the couch and I wrote, it happened to be a yellow legal pad on the coffee table in front of me. So I wrote those questions out on the coffee table. What does it take to make life work? I don't know what I thought I was doing. Just writing it out, wanting to get out of my system, I guess, writing an angry letter to God. And that's when I heard a voice over my right shoulder, and a very gentle, soft voice that simply said, I can't even describe whether it was male or female, but it was a very soft voice that simply said, Neil, do you want answers to these questions? Or are you just venting? Of course, I turned around, there was no one there, and I thought, terrific. Not only am I, angry as anything, but I'm going out of my mind. There's nobody in the room. What am I imagining here? But then I kind of sat there on the couch, and I thought, stewing in my own juice, as it were, Jay, I thought to myself, well, you know what? I am venting. But if somebody has answers, I'd sure as hell like to receive them. And like that, like a download, in my mind, I received answers to the questions I had asked. And I had the presence of mind. I wasn't even dreaming about ever writing a book. I was just wanting to keep track of what I was, hearing in my mind. There was no voice outside of myself anymore. It was all in my mind. It sounded like the voice of my own thoughts, the voiceless voice of one's own thoughts, except that what was being said to me were things I'd never heard before in my life. And even some of the statements were in direct contradiction of what I had heard before in my life, about life, about God, about how it all works. Statements that were totally in contradiction, even a violation of many of the so-called truths that I had come to hear in my life, about God, about myself. I was 49 years old, so I had gone past my fascination with any particular faith tradition. I had looked at them hypothetically and philosophically, but not from a place of adopting those beliefs. I did it when I was young, when I was a child, and as a young man when I was 19 or 20. Yes, I did adopt some of those faith traditions, but not at this point in my life. But I did still have an idea that there's something out there. There's something larger. By the way, interestingly enough, Jay, I don't know whether you've seen this statistic lately, but anthropological surveys have shown in the past 5 years that I was not alone in that idea. 8 out of 10 people, according to those surveys, you can look this up on the internet, 8 out of 10 people in every culture on the planet believe in some sort of higher power. They say, there's something larger going on. There's something bigger out there. They just don't know how to describe it, what it wants, what it needs, what it requires, much less how to use it, but what happens if we don't do what it demands, so to speak. So we can't seem to agree on anything else except that we do agree, apparently 80% of us agree that something is larger than us exists out there in the cosmos. And so, some of us call it God, Yahweh, Jehovah, Allah, whatever word, Brahman, that we choose to use to describe that ineffable essence that we refer to as the divine. So here I am writing this letter to God and getting these answers. And so, of course, the answers I was getting brought up other questions. So I would say, well, what about this? And then I would get an answer. And I'd, but what about this? I had all my yeah buts. I called them yeah buts. Yeah, but what about that? Oh, okay, yeah, but what about this? And that led into an ongoing dialogue that Jay had me setting up for the rest of the night. I think it was 10 o'clock in the morning before I stopped with the experience of questions and answers. I was astonished that this dialogue was going on in my mind, but I didn't miss a word of it. I took it all down, and I found it fascinating. Then the next night, you're going to be sorry you asked this question, because I got a 3.5-hour answer, but I'm going to try to keep it condensed. So the next night, I got up at 4:20 in the morning, and I thought, I really want to continue that experience. So I went to the living room, reached for my yellow legal pad, and picked up where I left off. This went on for, I would say, 3 or 4 weeks until I had pages and pages. I mean, really, I went out and bought a couple more yellow legal pads. I had 4 or 5 yellow legal pads filled with handwritten questions and answers that continued to fascinate me. Then somewhere in the middle of that experience, I received this information. I was told, you will make of this one day a book, and it will be read by many people. Many people will have access to it. And I thought to myself at that point, now I got you. Whatever this is that's going on. I started to call it my own private conversation with God. But I thought, now we got you, because this is a statement that could be measured. Jay, you got to understand the importance of this statement. This will one day become a book. It was not theoretical. It was not theological. It was not conceptual. It was an absolute statement of fact. All the rest of the stuff I was receiving were, in fact, philosophical, theological statements. Could be true, could not be true. Who would know? Who would know? But here was a statement I could measure. This will one day become a book, would either happen or it wouldn't. And I thought, of course, it's not going to become a book. No publisher in their right mind is going to publish a book. Handwritten notes from some guy who claims to be, I could just see the editor or the publisher of one of those publishing houses going out to the workroom floor where his editors are all sitting at desks. I could just imagine him. Hey, hang on, guys. Hang on. Hold the presses. Stop the presses. I got a guy here who's talking to God. It's not going to happen. Of course, I knew it wasn't in a million years. No one's going to publish this stuff. Boy, was I wrong. Not only did a publisher pick it up and put the book out, excuse me, not bragging, just saying, it sold 1 million copies, more than 1 million copies. They lost count after the first 1 million. Wound up being translated into 37 languages. Wound up being read around the world. They tell us now in New York, anecdotally, probably since that time to now, 15 or 20 million people have laid their eyes on that book, either by buying it or having it given to them by a friend. It's what they call in the publishing business a hand-to-hand book. That is, it's a book that's handed from hand to hand to hand, passed on down from husband to wife, wife to brother-in-law, brother-in-law to sister, sister to uncle, uncle to aunt, and just gets handed on down. 5 or 6 people, they're telling us in New York, have probably read every single copy that's actually been purchased. So I thought, oh, wow, this is interesting. Clearly, this was never meant just for me. Clearly, I'm simply an instrument, a messenger, if you will, not even a teacher. Very clearly, I don't accept the label of teacher. But clearly, I was given the opportunity to be a messenger, to pass on to millions of people what has been given to all of us to become more aware of it, to more deeply understand. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. By the way, I should add that after this experience of the first series of notes being accepted for publication, I continued to have the experience. I didn't stop having what I called my conversations with God. Quite to the contrary, I continued to have back and forth dialogue, still by hand, till I finally switched to a computer somewhere around book three. But I continued to have the experience of back and forth, question and answer, until ultimately 9 books were produced in that Q&A format, question, answer, including a book more recently, just 2 or 2.5 years ago, called Conversations with God, Book 4, but several other books in between with other titles, Tomorrow's God, and Friendship with God, Communion with God, and other books in the so-called With God series. I simply woke up one night in August of 2017, I believe it was, and unexpectedly found myself urged, is the word I would use, to get back to my keyboard. At that point, I was doing all of my writing on a computer. But I had this deep urge, and I hadn't felt that urge for almost 10 years, that particular kind of feeling. It has a particular energetic signature. That's the only way I can describe it. And so the energetic signature was familiar to me, although I had not experienced or felt that particular energetic, as I said, for over a decade. But I went, wow, am I being invited to have another dialogue? Because I really thought at that point that my conversation with God, if you will, had concluded, that I'd reached the conclusion of that experience, and that I was finished with that particular level of encounter. But no, here was this feeling. So I jumped out of bed. Again, it was whatever, 4:25 in the morning. And I threw the covers back and went down to my little writing room, and I began to produce what became Conversations with God, Book 4. That book came through me in, it was a full-length book, but it came through me in about 3.5 weeks, very quickly, very rapidly. I was writing, I was bringing the dialogue through, I want to say, maybe 6 or 7, 8 hours a day. I stopped, to eat a little bit of lunch, have a little bit of dinner. Then I went right to sleep because I was getting up at 4 o'clock, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, wanting to get back to the process. So that's how the book came. And the book was astonishing to me in that I thought really there wasn't much more to say. But there weren't very many more questions I had to ask. But it did open more deeply into the areas of highly evolved beings, which were abbreviated in the book as HEBS, H-E-B-S. And I began to affectionately call them HEBS, highly evolved beings. So I then came to understand, to answer your first question, what is my thought about the UFO phenomena and all of that? Of course, it's not simply a phenomena, it's a reality. We call it a phenomena because we don't yet fully understand it. But almost everything that we now understand to be part of our real world, our so-called scientific discoveries, our medical discoveries, all these ventures into the world of deeper understanding were once called phenomena. Now they're not called phenomena, they're called reality. So I call it reality 20 years ahead of time. even in the earlier books, in book 3 it was talked about.
Yeah, there was some mention.
Directly. So my answer to your first question is it's a reality. Clearly, highly evolved beings exist elsewhere in the universe. Clearly, there is intelligent life in the cosmos, even if there isn't any on Earth. But clearly, there is intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, and it would be impossible to imagine that there is not. I mean, my goodness, there are billions and trillions and kajillions of stars, to say nothing about how many planets revolve around those stars, which we call suns. Our stars is our sun, of course. So around every one of the kajillions of stars, is a galaxy of or a solar system, a cluster of planets, and surely on at least one of those other planets, if not millions, if you please, there is intelligent life, and surely some of that intelligent life has advanced, if you will, beyond where we are now in terms of our evolutionary process as a species. So I'm very clear in my understanding and in my deepest belief that highly evolved beings are not figments of anyone's imagination. They exist in the universe. I also was told directly that they are looking, if I could put it this way, looking after us in a certain way, doing what they can without directly interfering, without directly inserting, you know, certain pieces of information that would be far more advanced than we are able to accept or to work with in a beneficial way. Be kind of like teaching calculus to a fourth grader, information they couldn't use, and that could even in some ways be dangerous. So there is, you know, a universal, in my understanding, a universal rule, if you please, a universal clarity that civilizations that are advanced do not pass on to primitive civilizations. And ours, by the way, is primitive. If you don't think that we are a primitive civilization, just look at yesterday's headlines. Obviously, we're primitive. We have world leaders insulting each other. I mean, insulting each other. You know, basically acting like two-year-olds. Our missiles are bigger than your missiles. And if you're not careful, we'll send our missiles your way and destroy your country. We have the ability, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like two-year-olds arguing in the backyard, except that they're arguing with very dangerous tools, including, as we know, nuclear weapons, biological weapons, and to say nothing of psychological weapons. So we are a very, very primitive, extremely primitive species, just now growing into what we could call metaphorically our adolescence as a civilization, just beginning to even think of life in ways that we have not been able to imagine before now. And so the question is, who's going to win the human race? Are we going to win this human race? Or will we lose the race and destroy ourselves? I want to say again, because we've done it before. I do think, however, the time is not unlimited, that we don't have, you know, any time, don't worry about it, that I think that we are entering a period that's critical time-wise, and that we need to make some changes and some alterations in our behaviors and in our understandings and in our most fundamental beliefs rather quickly. By quickly, I don't mean hours or minutes or days or weeks, but certainly we can't afford to wait another 50 or 100 years to make the kinds of changes in our beliefs and our behaviors that I'm talking about. So I think that time is limited, but yes, this isn't the perfect time because, and we've, as I mentioned a minute ago, we approached this time once before when we had the technical capability of virtually destroying life as we know it on this planet, and we did that. We did that once before. So here we are again, cycling back to that same place where we have the ability to bring an end to life as we know it on this planet. And we have to make the same decisions we were invited to make once before in the days of Atlantis and other so-called mythologies that we've heard about that turned out to be in fact true. There are entities that are taking a close look at our civilization and doing so with impunity, whether it's at military installations or any other way. But, you know, if they wanted to do us damage or some kind of hurt, and I'm not sure that this is what the military is saying in our country. By our country, I mean the United States, where I live. I'm not sure that the military is saying so much, but I think what's important for us to understand is, you know, if these highly evolved beings, if these entities, if you will, intended to do us damage, harm. They could have done that 150 years ago or earlier, to say nothing of last week or last month or last year or 20 years ago. So the evidence suggests that they mean us no harm, but that they simply want to find out and to learn and are finding ways to discover with impunity what our current capabilities are, so that they don't inadvertently create a response from the military establishments of this world that could inure against our own benefit, that could hurt us. You know, much as you would tell a child, you know, be careful, don't play with matches. But before you did that, you'd have to find out whether the child even found a way to get access to matches or even know what matches are or how they work. So I think that what the highly evolved beings are doing is they're acting as college graduates with PhDs looking into the bedroom of their grandchildren to see if they have yet figured out how to use a match and what a lighter is and what fire is all about. And if they see that the children have the ability to start the house on fire, they may step in and let the child know in whatever way they can, you don't want to play with matches. Right now we are children playing with matches, to use a metaphor. I think so. That's my understanding of the relationship, the three-way relationship between highly evolved beings, human beings, and our so-called defensive military establishments, not just in this country, but in other countries as well, that are starting to pay attention to what the U.S. military is saying. The God Solution emerged as a title when I found myself beginning this latest book with a question, which I called the God Dilemma, which is different from the God Delusion. The God Delusion is, you know, as I understood, I haven't read the book, but I've heard about it. And from what I imagine it to be saying, Mr. Dawkins has been sharing his notion that people are deluded that with regard to the question of God, that we have been somehow, you know, deluded into thinking there is such a thing as God, and that it's all not true, and that we need to get our thinking straight. But the God Dilemma is not quite the same as the God Delusion in my vernacular. To me, the God Dilemma is a different question. It's a question that, it's a statement, if you please, or a description of people who do believe in God. They've gone past the God Delusion. That is, I don't think they don't see themselves as being deluded around it. Of course, no one who's deluded sees themselves as being deluded, or they wouldn't be deluded, obviously. But these are people who have a firm belief in a higher power, in my observation. But they don't know about that higher power. They don't know what it is, what it wants, what it requires, if anything. What happens if it doesn't get what it requires from us? And most profoundly of all, they don't know how to use the higher power, or much less that it can be used in almost a mechanical way, in almost a consistent, predictable way. So I called that as I began to write this piece, and it started off with just a question, basically. What's the point of having a God with the world such a mess? Yeah, I wrote the book in the middle of the pandemic, in the middle of the challenges we were facing globally with our economies collapsing or certainly shifting in major ways, and with even, you know, the increased awareness of racial injustice and some other ways in which we are behaving with each other in a rather primitive way. So looking at all of that, I started to ask a question of myself, and I put the question in writing. The book begins with the question. If there is a God, What's the point? What's the good of it? What's the use of it? Why bother having a God when the world is in such a mess? And for that matter, if you don't mind my saying so, that the species has been in one kind of a mess or another for thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of years. If it hasn't been this, it's been that. If it hasn't been this, it's been that. We've not had easy going on this planet at any point in time. Perhaps small numbers of people have, but in the largest sense, it's not been an easy trip here on the Earth. So what's the point of having a God? And so I began the book with that question. Or is it possible, just possible, that there's something we don't fully understand here about God, the understanding of which would change everything? And that's what I began to deeply explore. If that was true, and it may not be true, hey, it's a hypothesis. I wrote the book as an hypothesis. But if that were true, hypothetically speaking, is it interesting enough for us and critical enough for us to begin to deeply explore what we've been told we're not supposed to explore? Don't ask questions. Do not ask questions. The answer has been given to you. The answers have been given to all of us. So you're not to question the answers we've been given. But is it time for us? Is it time for us as a species to finally ask the so-called unaskable question? The questions that are only asked by heretics or apostates or blasphemers, if you will. Dare we ask the blasphemous question? Do we have a misunderstanding here about God, about life itself, and about who we are? A misunderstanding so gargantuan that we have created these messes that I've been talking about ourselves, and we're waiting for God to somehow undo or unravel all the problems that we've created? When God has given us, in fact, all the tools we need with which to unravel it, we're simply not using the tools. So what is it that we don't understand, the understanding of which? To delve deeply. And then the book offers three in particular interesting answers. One, it offers a brand new definition of God. Let's start from scratch. Let's throw out all the old definitions of God and start with a brand new definition of God. A definition of God so different from our traditional definitions as to even call it spiritually revolutionary. Second, let's offer a process that people could use, a different way of engaging life. Throwing out the ancient idea that your thoughts can change your reality. Or not really throwing it out, but expanding it to a new level. What if there was a tool even more powerful than your thoughts? What if all those, and there are many, many books, by the way, what if all those books about the power of positive thinking, as you think it, so shall it be, and all the rest, what if those books simply stopped short and didn't even come up with the whole and total answer? So that's the second tool that we are given in this book. And the third tool is a complete set of answers on how to master the mechanics of metaphysics. And I call these tools, these three aspects, all clumped together, I call it the God solution. There is a solution to the God dilemma, and I call it the God solution. And I invite people to take a look at it. I could be wrong about all of it. If it doesn't make any sense to anybody, throw it out. I mean, really, burn the book, tear it up and throw it away. But you know what's interesting? And then I'm done with my little diatribe here, but you know what's interesting? People who have read it are not throwing it away. They're not burning it. Practically to a person, they're saying, there it is, the God solution. So my thought about it is, if we can get enough people to pass on information to enough other people, we could finally win this human race. But what has not been largely understood until recent times is, in fact, that everything is energy. You know, I hate to be simplistic, but everything in the universe is simply a manifestation of a certain oscillation of energy. And so all there is to life is energy in some form or another. And we call, or at least I call, the sum total of all that energy, God. That is what people call the higher power. There is a higher power, and the higher power is the sum total of all the energy in the universe clumped into one, if you please, and sourced from a particular place, from a particular source in the universe, sourced by the source, which is like magic. It becomes the sorcerer.
Yeah. So
what we are invited by life to understand is that if life really is nothing more than various oscillations of energy, is there any way that we can affect or impact that oscillation? That is, can energy affect energy in a way that alters the energy we seek to affect? And of course, the answer is yes. It does it all the time. We do it mostly on this planet, inadvertently, unconsciously, without even knowing we're doing it, because only recently, and when I say recently, I mean in the most recent couple hundred years. I don't mean, you know, in the most recent 1,000 years, but in the last 200 or 300 years, we've come to really deeply understand that, yes, we're using this energy all the time. As the book, The God Solution, puts it, the power is always on. The power is always on. And what God is inviting us to do is to use that power in the way that we would choose to use it to produce the outcomes of our preference. But right now, we're using that power, most of us, most people, unconsciously, without being aware that we're doing it. And that's why we're seeing the outcomes that we are seeing. But the foundational energetic is what we want to discuss. If we truly want to change our moment-to-moment, hour-to-hour, day-to-day behaviors, and that foundational energy, in my language, I call God. What is God really? Put it in a sentence for me, please, ladies and gentlemen. What is God? And what the God Solution suggests is that God can be redefined with two simple words. A two-word definition of God. And so my audiences, when I give these lectures, recently in the past few months, online, I haven't been doing any lectures in person because of the dilemma that we've created on this planet with the pandemic. But in my online lectures, I've been saying, okay, here's the two-word definition of God. God is pure love. And inevitably, somebody from the audience raises their hand, and I call them to the stage, and they say, I thought you were going to give us something really revolutionary, something brand new. Everyone understands God is love. That's the brand new idea? Whoop-de-doo. Who would disagree with that? Excuse me. Anyone who agrees there is a God would say God is love. I said, wait a minute, guys. You got to hear what I said. I didn't say God is love. You didn't hear me say God is love. That would be simplistic and predictable and old hat. I said God is pure love. That's a particular kind of love. Not human love, not love as we humans have understood it. And then my questioner will say, oh, okay, what's the difference? The difference is that pure love wants, needs, hopes for, and demands nothing in return. Nothing. And so the book asks an astonishing question. Dare we believe? Can we be idea heroes and embrace a thought that we've had it all wrong about God from the beginning? That God is not simply observing, Can we release the notion that God is also judging and then condemning and then punishing? Because if we can release those ideas, we then have a new model upon which to base human behaviors. See, we're all trying to do what we understand God does. We try to treat each other the way we understand God treats us, with judgment, condemnation, and punishment. But what if God did not treat us that way? Now, when I say this is revolutionary, you got to understand. Check it out. Don't believe me. Just check it out. 90% of the world's religions teach of a God of judgment, condemnation, and punishment. Look into it. It might take you some time, by the way, because you may not know that there are 4,300 religions on the face of the earth. You heard me right. I said there are 4,300 organized religions on the planet right now, each with their own set of understandings and awarenesses, but none of which violate or step away from the central notion that unless we do what God wants, God will judge us, condemn us, and punish us. And these are not small things. I'll get to this current diatribe in a minute, but let me share with you how deep this goes. Billions of people, not a couple hundred thousand, not a couple hundred million, but billions of people believe that if you don't belong to the right religion, if you don't belong to a particular religion, you're going to hell. You will suffer endless punishment, torture, agony in the fires of hell because you simply chose the wrong religion. Doesn't matter how nice you were, how kind you were, how good you were, how patient you were, how understanding you were, how loving you were, how generous you were, how forgiving you were. None of that matters. You could be the nicest person on the face of the earth, but you know what? What can I tell you? You belong to the wrong religion. And, you know, to use God's words, them's the rules. So you're out. You're out. But if you belong to the right religion, you're in, no matter how you behave. You can even be a scoundrel. But if in the end you believe in God in a certain way, God will forgive you. So I have brought forth a different revolutionary idea. I get asked and invited to talk in churches a lot. And the first thing I say at churches is, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm glad to see you here. I've come to you today and I stand here in the pulpit before you to bring you an interesting message. God will never forgive you for anything. And the place goes crazy. The people don't know what to do with that. I have to say, well, you know, let me explain. God will not forgive you for anything because it's impossible for you to hurt, injure, damage, upset, frustrate, or anger God in any way. Any more than a 3-year-old child could frustrate and anger you enough to make you want to punish it with everlasting punishment of some sort. And why? When your 3-year-old granddaughter spills the milk into your lap, maybe you did it deliberately as a joke, maybe, or perhaps as a mistake. What do you say to that 3-year-old granddaughter? Go to your room. Don't come out of your room for the next 17 years. I'll teach you. And you're lucky I didn't make you stay in there for the rest of your life. No, we don't punish a 3-year-old girl. We don't chastise a 3-year-old boy for making those kinds of mistakes or for pulling a bad joke that didn't turn out really well. We don't do that. No, what the grandpa says to the grandchild is, it's okay, sweetheart. I forgive you. No, we don't even do that. You don't forgive a 3-year-old child. Forgiveness is not part of the equation. What do you do when the child sees what she's done and that she didn't really mean to create such an outcome? And she starts to cry at her own mistake, her own misbehavior. Do we punish the child? Do we condemn the child? Do we forgive the child? No, we don't do any of that. We hold the child in our arms. bring the child to us close, embrace the child with love. And we say to the child, it's okay, sweetheart. Grandpa loves you. It's okay, don't cry. Don't cry. It's okay. And you know what? I have this crazy thought that God is at least as nice as my grandpa. Could be wrong. I could be wrong. But I don't think so. That's the God solution. Why is the world in such a mess? Because we're a very young species. Because we are the three-year-olds of the universe, metaphorically speaking. And it's been written in another book, the title of which I have forgotten in a moment, but it's a wonderful book. I think it's called New World, New Time. I forgot the title of it, but forgive me. But in the book, we're given an analogy. We're invited by the authors of the book to think of the planet Earth and its age. Think of the age of the Earth and overlay it on a calendar year, just for purposes of scale. And the authors say, if you took the, and they've researched this, by the way, this is not just an opinion. They looked at this anthropologically speaking. If you take the Earth and overlay it on a calendar year in terms of age, like the Earth came into being on January 1st into making today December 31st, if we take the age of the Earth on a calendar year basis, then the first form of life, single cell life, the most primitive form of life, occurred on this planet, on this third rock from the sun, in February of on this calendar year. More sophisticated life forms, birds in the air, fish in the sea, appeared on the Earth somewhere around the end of November on that scale. On that scale, dinosaurs first appeared on the Earth on December the 5th. On that time scale, dinosaurs disappeared from the Earth on December the 25th. On that time scale, humanoids, that is, not human beings, but animals that began to walk on two legs and act a bit like humans, appeared on December 31st. And on that scale, the entirety of human history, as we have recorded it, took place in the last 60 seconds of the year. Now, that's how young we are in as a species in relationship to the age of the Earth. Forget about the age of the cosmos. In terms of the age of the cosmos, we're like a blink of an eye old. And that's the answer to the question. Why are we in such a mess? Why have we been behaving the way we've been behaving? And why are we creating not all, but the largest number of the disasters that have been visited upon the human species? That's the answer. It's like asking a two-year-old, why did you spill the milk? Because you're 2 years old. It's as simple as that. And you don't have to be forgiven for that. Here's something that I want everybody listening to this program to write in their bathroom, on the bathroom mirror. I want you to place this message on your bathroom mirror. Put it out there in lipstick or get a bar of soap and write it in soap or put a little message on a piece of paper and tack it to the bathroom mirror. Remember this always. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. Did you catch that? I'll give it to you again in case you missed it. Write it down. Understanding replaces forgiveness in the mind of the master. When we understand how a person could do such a thing, whatever it is that we are bemoaning, when we understand, for that matter, how we could do some of the things that we have done, said some of the things that we have said, when we understand, then we forego forgiveness. And we go right straight to compassion and love and to solution. Not who's to blame, but what's the solution? And I call this the God solution. See, one last thing, Jay. There's a process called melding, and it's offered in the book as a powerful process, a powerful tool. We've been told, book after book after book, your thoughts create your reality. As a man thinketh was written by James, a man named James, not forget his name, many, many years ago, at the beginning of the last century. The book was called As a Man Thinketh. Other books have come along since then. As I mentioned earlier, The Power of Positive Thinking, As You Think So Will Be Done Unto You, blah, 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 blah. What we now know is that that's, here we go again, a primitive level of metaphysical utilization. What we really want to use is not our thoughts, but our emotions. Emotion is emotion, energy in motion. Those emotions can be created by our thoughts, but the emotions are the most powerful form of energetic projection. So we are invited to not only pay attention to the first emotion that comes up for us whenever anything is occurring in our life, but in fact to meld our emotion with what we understand God's feeling to be. And God's feeling would be, in every case, pure love. Pure love. Love that requires, asks for, demands, expects nothing in return. So now when we are confronted with any exterior event or circumstance in our life, be it intensely personal or global in nature, we get to look at our own emotion as it arises within us and then meld that with God's feeling until our emotion and God's feeling become one. And then let that be the energy that we project onto the outer circumstance, event, or experience with which we are confronted. If everyone did that, the world would change overnight. It's really quite simple. You could call it the God solution. Are you saying we shouldn't punish those who do bad things to us? Are you saying that we shouldn't judge anybody else? Nobody should ever be condemned? What are you trying to say? But if we listen to the teachings of some of the world's greatest teachers, we will hear an interesting thought echoing through the eons. Interesting thought echoing through all the teachings of all the teachers. One teacher put it in a way that made it pretty hard to forget. He said, love, love, love your enemies. And pray for those who persecute you. And do good to those who would do you harm. And raise not your fist to heaven. And curse the darkness not. But be a light unto the darkness. That you might know who you really are. And that all those whose lives you touch will one day know who they really are as well. Maybe I misunderstood what he was trying to tell us. But I don't think so. See, because everything I've said here for the past hour or so revolves around a larger understanding of who we really are. So it doesn't become difficult. It becomes easy when you understand who you really are. That is, let's see, who am I? Am I just a physical entity? Am I just a physical life form? Not unlike that bird in the sky or the fish in the sea. A bit more complex, perhaps, fair enough. But at the bottom line, just another form of life. You know, I'm born, I live, I die, and that's it. Or is it possible? Just possible. That I'm more than that. That I'm a spiritual entity. Having a body and a mind. What if my body is not who I am? What if it's something I have? What if my mind is not the essence of me, but simply something that I use? What if my true identity is that I'm a spiritual being, having a physical experience? If that were true, I mean, hypothetically, if that were true, wouldn't we then have an entirely different context within which to experience what's going on, and a new way to understand why it would even make sense to love those who have hurt you, and to extend love to that person who has hurt us. Because if we understood that we were spiritual entities, it would be clear to us that we can't be hurt. The essence of who we are cannot be hurt, damaged, destroyed, upset, disappointed, frustrated, or injured in any way. My spirit isn't going to be hurt or damaged or injured if you say bad things about me. I mean, by the way, speaking about having bad things said about him, I had the newspapers in London calling me a heretic. Newspapers in Singapore calling me, in fact, an apostate, a blasphemer. People around the world are calling me names. And in some cases, some pretty important people. You know what? Gotta love them. Gotta have compassion for anyone who's coming from their deepest belief, hoping to do so without injury to another, conjuring up the bravery to say for them what's true for them. And hopefully, if nothing else, we can find a way to disagree agreeably. But only if I understood who I really am and what my purpose is. So I'm clear now that I'm not a physical life form. Simply, I am in fact a spiritual being, having a physical experience, and the point of it, in order to serve the agenda of the soul. And the agenda of the soul? Evolution, my friend. The expansion of my awareness, of my understanding, of my expression, of my demonstration, and of my experience of my true identity. That I am, in fact, an individuation of divinity. I am to God as a wave is to the ocean. The wave is not separate from the ocean. It's not other than the ocean. It's simply a magnificent, powerful, beautiful, glorious expression arising from the ocean. And when that expression is complete, it recedes back into the ocean whence it came. That is precisely the relationship that I have with God. And my physical life provides me an opportunity to demonstrate that. And in the moments when I demonstrate it, not nearly enough, thank you very much, but in the moments when I do, I have experienced the bliss, the joy, the fulfillment of who I really am. All of you have. There's not a person in the sound of my voice right now who has not had at least one or two moments in their life when they've been their most magnificent self, even forgave the unforgivable, showed up as more generous than they ever thought they could possibly be, experienced their most magnificent self, and when they walk away from that moment, they say to themselves, now that's who I am. That's who I am. What would it take for me to be that in every moment of my life? Ah, so he said, that wonderful guy who came from your country. He put it perfectly. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to rise up against a sea of troubles and by opposing to end them, or as he said somewhere else in his writing, there are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. Whatever you want to experience in your life, whatever it might be, staying in that place of center, or whatever else your objective might be in any moment, be the source of that. In the experience of another, cause another to have the experience that you wish to have, and you'll discover that what flows through you sticks to you. It's not a mistake. It's not a coincidence that virtually every major spiritual messenger that we know of in human history has been a teacher, has shared this experience with others. So, simply be the cause of what you wish to experience. Be the cause of that in the life of another. I was asked that question by Matt Lauer on the Today Show, a major television morning show in America. What's the most important message of the Conversations with God books, in your opinion? And it came when I asked God, what does it take? What does it take? My very first question. What does it take to make life work? And I remember the answer I got was a little bit of a chuckle in God's voice. Not a derisive chuckle, not an insulting kind of an energy, but just the kind of way you chuckle if a 3 or 4 year old asked you, how many stars are in the sky? You would just chuckle at the beautiful, pure innocence of the question. And you'd give the best answer you could give. And the answer that I received to my question, what does it take to make life work? What is it that I don't understand? And she said, Sweetheart, it's so simple. You think your life is about you, and your life has nothing to do with you. It's about everyone whose life you touch and the way in which you touch it. Yet if you come from that place, you will see that in the larger sense, life is about you, because guess what? There's nobody else here. All things are one thing. There is only one thing. And all things are part of the one thing there is. Therefore, what you do for me, you do for you. What you fail to do for another, you fail to do for you. It's really quite simple. But I did say in the book that we have created a rewards must be earned theology. A theology that says there's wonderful stuff awaiting for you in heaven, but there are things you have to do to deserve it. There are things you have to do to deserve my love. There are things you have to avoid doing that you may not do to deserve my love. But if you do those things or avoid those things that I told you to avoid, then, or if I'm in the mood to forgive you, if you, fail in some of those areas, then maybe you can deserve to come back to me in heaven and spend eternity in paradise. But it's a reward and punishment universe that we live in, that I have created, says God. And so what I have been told in my conversations with God, and what I've explained quite clearly and simply and with great focus in the God Solution, is maybe that's what we have not understood. Is it possible that there's something we don't completely understand here about God and about life and about ourselves, the understanding of which would change everything? And the answer is yes. We don't understand that we do not live in a reward and punishment universe. We live in a universe of unconditional love. And that there's no way, when we do the thing called die, or what I say, when we celebrate our continuation day, there's no way that we're not going to return to that place that some of us describe as paradise. That we don't return to the spiritual realm, experience our oneness with God, with all that is, with everyone else who's ever touched our lives, and oneness, in fact, with ourselves in a profound way. There's no way that we will be judged, condemned, or punished. And so that's why we focus so highly on the idea that we do not live in any reward or punishment universe, because that implication has enormous impact with regard to life on Earth. What if we created a construction of life on Earth that was not foundationed in a reward and punishment paradigm? What if you didn't have to do anything to get me to love you and to get me to give you all the gifts I have to give without needing anything in return? Is it possible for a species such as ours to move into such a culture? I'm saying yes to answer the question you asked before, because that would be a utopian society. But we are capable of creating that, and I'm suggesting to you that it has been created and does exist elsewhere in this cosmos.